It was one of the coolest things. I'll tell you all about it. You listen to the podcast that we're about to record, and you'll hear the whole story. Well, I'm not going to waste it now, right? All right, Reggie, we're ready to go. I like where those levels are bouncing there. Keep them there. Keep them there. And we'll get started. What do you say? Huh? Sounds good. All right. I will give you the three S's. I'll give you the countdown. You give me the music. And I will give you a very fun, I think it's going to be a very fun podcast. I'm already saying that before I've even started. How about that? Huh? When we're done, you can tell me if I was exaggerating or not. Okay, Reg? Okay. All right, here we go. You ready? Got the music go? Okay, I'll give you three S's here and we'll get started here. All right. Three S's. Star, smile, strong. Here we go. Three. Oh, put it in the book. 251. Episode 251. All right, here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com, or we are found wherever you go to find your favorite podcasts. We are there! It only makes sense, right? Favorite podcasts? We are there. Logic leads you to deduce that we are one of your favorite podcasts. Wow, a long way to go for that, wasn't it? Anyway, welcome to, let's see, what is it now? Episode 251. Who would have thought we would have gotten past 250? Don't forget, if you like what you hear, you can go to WGNRadio.com and go to the prompt for this podcast. You'll find all previous 250 episodes. And don't forget, your responsibility as a regular listener is not just to hit the play button and put on your headphones. No. It's much more than that. Let's get out there. Get out in the real world. Tell your friends. Tell your family. Tell whoever. You respect their opinion. Tell them that you are a fan of the Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic podcast, and they should be too. So send them a link. Send them a message. Send them whatever you have to do, but get out there and spread the word. Your loyalty and your devotion and that little extra effort, well, I appreciate it, and doesn't it make you feel good? It should. So here we are at episode 251 as we march on. A few weeks ago, on my Facebook page, I had a posting up commemorating, I guess is the right word, right? What has it been now? Seven, yeah. The 14 years ago, right now, starting in February, actually late January, but in February and through March. So 14 years ago, 2007. Can't say 2007. I've told you that before. It's not an O. It's not a letter. Now, that's difficult. As I said before, with the 2000, once you get past the zeros, the aughts, if you will, I believe you need to start saying 2010, 2011, 2012, just like we said 1972, 1964, 1955, 1998. We didn't say 1998. So we shouldn't say 2021. But it is difficult when you get to those aughts, when you're at those aughts at 2001, 2001. But it's not an O, it's a zero, right? We've always fallen into that trap, even when we used to say our phone numbers, you'd say an O instead of a zero. No, it's a zero. They're all numbers. We don't mix letters in with numbers. So I guess, but at the same time, it is awkward to say 2007, right? 2008, 2009. So I guess I could say 2007. So I'll give you that 2000 up that first decade, those first 9 years from 2000 to 2000, 9. But after that, right where we're at now in 2021, no, there's no more 2000s. You don't say 2021. It's over. We've been in this decade for 20, in this century now, for 20 years and counting. I know it's hard to believe, but we've already been there that long. So please, this is a little pet peeve of mine I've talked about in the past, but maybe I just, at this point, needed to revisit it, because I was falling into a trap too. So just as a little reminder, when you're referencing any year from 2000 to 2009, you can say 2000, but don't say 2000 and, it's 2007, 2008. There's no and in that either. It's all numbers. There's no words. 2001, 2002, 2003. But once you get past 2009, you start to use the 20, just like we did in the 19th and 18th century. It's 1700, you know, 1742, 1897, 1974, 2021. Can we all agree to that? Anyway, to get back to my story, 20. No, one. See, I'm screwing up myself. 2007, 14 years ago, right now, I was in a play, a musical, on stage, the Buddy Holly story. It's called Buddy, the Buddy Holly story. And it's a jukebox musical and tells the story of Buddy Holly's career and life using his music to dramatize the different scenes leading up to his tragic death in early February in 1959, when he and the Big Bopper and Richie Valens crashed in a plane in Iowa. They had just done a show at Clear Lake in Iowa, and they pretty much crashed right on takeoff. There was a lot of questions, as most of those crashes are. They're pilot error in many occasions, especially back in the 50s and 60s when, you know, airplane flying was relatively new to some extent, especially smaller planes. But I brought this up. I made a posting of it just to say, hey, you know, 14 years ago today or this month or this week, you know, I was in one of my most memorable and my favorite productions and plays and roles that I've ever done. I've been acting in plays around the Chicago area and the suburbs since around 2003. Wow. See, so I can't be mad at anyone else, because listen to me. I went on this whole big soapbox 5 minutes ago, and then when I'm just talking without thinking, I fall right into it. In 2003, see, now, folks, here's the thing. I could have easily stopped the tape, started over, and done it correctly, and you would have said, wow, see, at least Jim practices what he preaches. But I'm keeping it in. I'm not stopping the tape. Reggie, the producer, is not hitting the stop button, because I do believe in exposing all those faults that we all have, warts and all. That's what this podcast is all about. Oh, I could have stopped the tape. I could have stopped the recording, and you never would have known, and you would have said, wow, at least, well, Jim does, you know, there he was. He was on this soapbox talking about the 2000s and the 2008s and the 2010s, and when he said it correctly. I just need to know, I am far from perfect. I can get on my soapbox, but at least I caught myself. That's the thing. I'm catching myself when I do it, and I'm trying to think about it and correct myself. So let me continue with my story, but I just wanted to let you know, we're always about transparency on this podcast and honesty and truth. So I didn't edit it out. I didn't start over. I just let you hear me make that mistake, warts and all, and that's why you love Elton Jim, isn't it? Anyway, in 2003... See how I corrected myself? I've been acting, and I have been in a variety of different shows, dramas, comedies, a few musicals. I'm not a trained singer per se, but I can carry a tune. I actually sing better when I sing like other people. When I do impersonations of people, I sing better than... I don't really have a distinct kind of voice. or a trained singing voice. But when I imitate people singing, I do. I don't know why that happens, but it does. But anyway, so I had posted this on my Facebook page, and I had a couple of pictures of me from this Buddy Holly production of, you know, Buddy, the show. And somebody mentioned in the comments on the post that, wow, because I added a little background. Hey, you know, 14 years ago, I was in this play and, you know, this musical, and I had a great time, and I was able to, you know, live out my rock and roll fantasies, and I, you know, all that lip syncing and standing in front of the mirror as a kid and pretending that I was Elton John or Bruce Springsteen or my favorite performers, I got a chance to actually act that out and put it to good use after all those years of just doing it in my bedroom. And so somebody mentioned in a comment, wow, I that sounds like it was must have been so fun. I'd love to hear the whole story. And I was thinking about that. You know, a lot of times we take so much for granted about our own lives and our own little stories and events that happen to us that oftentimes we forget that they actually do make for pretty good stories. Now, that's what I do on this podcast, so I might be a little more aware of it or sensitive to it because that's sort of what my gig is here than maybe the average person. I always look for something or try to say, hey, remember when that happened and how can I relate that story to make it sound interesting? But I didn't even really think of a possible, you know, something to talk about here on the podcast. But when the person mentioned that they'd like to hear some background on it, I was like, you know what? It's actually a really good story, and it's multifaceted, and it's nostalgic, and there's some hints of sentimentality in there. So hopefully, I might even get you, you know, tug on your heart and maybe get your tear ducts to react. I don't know. There's a lot of different aspects to this story. So I thought, you know, that's not a bad idea. So once again, I listen, I take your input in seriously. If you do react to anything on my Facebook page about the podcast itself or any postings I have, I'm always looking for input and feedback. And if somebody does say something that might strike a chord with me, I will move forward on it. So once again, thank you very much. Always love that feedback and that input. So let me tell you about this story, because it really, it does hit on a lot of different aspects of my life, just kind of mashed together. So the original, well, it actually, and that's, I should, yeah, I have to go back to this. So let me go back to the real beginnings of this. When I was really beginning to discover different kinds of music and explore old music and new music, and you know it, whatever it is, in my late my early teens, even when I was 9 or 10 or 11, you know, I didn't have an older brother or sister to pass on some information. My parents were older when they had me, so they really weren't rock and roll fans. So a lot of this I had to find out on my own or through osmosis or get hints or information from other people. And I've been a music fan ever since I was, gosh, I would at least say 6 or 7. I was already buying records. Probably younger than most people, but as I said, I was an only child, and so for me, music was a nice companion. When I got done playing with my friends during the day, you know, they'd all go home and they'd have brothers and sisters to talk to or do things with or play games with them. But I was kind of on my own. And so I'd go into my room, and sometimes I'd be with my mom and dad watching TV. But, you know, sometimes I would just go to the solace of my bedroom, and music, the radio and the record player became a daily companion for me. And here we are, you know, 50-some decades, you know, 50 years later, 5 decades later, and it's still a major part of my life. So when I remember, I was about a freshman in high school, and I was fairly now adept at the current music, and really just immersed myself in the current music and the music of the several years before and after. But I really wasn't that well versed in the old rock and roll, the early rock and roll. I mean, I'd heard songs. I've heard stuff by Elvis. I heard stuff by, you know, Chuck Berry here and there, but didn't really immerse myself in it because I was first getting into what was in front of me. And then as I read about music and read about some of my favorite performers who would then reference their influences, which were mostly people from the 50s, obviously, then I would look them up and find out about them and read about them and then go out and buy an album. So that's, you know, I've said many times that, you know, thanks to Bruce Springsteen and Elton John, you know, I learned about Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis and Fats Domino and Buddy Holly and Phil Spector's Wall of Sound and the Beach Boys and that's where I got my education. That were at least where I got my exposure to that, reading about their influences, and then going and doing the research on my own, and then finding out, well, geez, if they like this music and it influenced them, then maybe I'll like it too because I like them. And it really did play out. And Buddy Holly, interestingly enough, was a influence of both Elton and Bruce Springsteen. And that even though their music may seem very, very different in terms of their roots or their sound, it is there. And they both cite Buddy Holly as an influence. In fact, you know, Elton John started wearing glasses because of Buddy Holly. He started wearing the dark horn-rimmed glasses to look like Buddy Holly, and it ultimately affected his sight. But he started wearing the glasses because of Buddy Holly. And if you listen to Bruce Springsteen's early music, especially on Born to Run, I mean, the song She's the One is basically, a Buddy Holly riff of Not Fade Away, and one of his classic songs. So the influences are there. So Buddy Holly was certainly on my radar screen because of being an early fan of both Bruce and Elton in the 70s. And I had heard the usual Buddy Holly songs on the oldie station back then. I mean, now you listen to an oldie station, they're playing stuff from the 90s. I mean, I don't know if there's any oldie stations playing 50s and even 60s music anymore. Certainly not 50s. But back in the 70s and 80s, an oldie station was considered playing 50s and 60s music. That was 20, 25 years before. And now we always go back about a generation, 25 years or more. So here we are in 2021. So, my gosh, an oldie station now might even be playing stuff from the early 2000s. How depressing is that? I mean, think about it. Wow. Elvis Presley, who came on the scene in 1955, I mean, his music now is 65 years old. Oh my God. Yeah, I don't know many, you know, oldie stations. That's like it's not even an oldie station. That's an ancient station, right? I would assume if you're 18 or 19 and you hear about music from 1955, that's like us in the 70s or 80s, those of us in this age group, listening to like Rudy Valley from the 1920s. We never did that, right? Wow. Okay. But anyway, rock and roll does seem to at least break down some of the more of the generation gap musically than earlier generations. There was a definite line between what old people, and I put that in quotes, older people listened to and younger people did. Now there certainly is a difference. I can't even watch the Grammy Awards anymore. I don't know who is on it. I don't know any of the songs. I really just feel very out of touch. I'm not embarrassed by it. That music is not meant for me. They're not writing it for me. So I don't feel bad about it. But yeah, I mean, there was a certain, at least rock and roll, when you go to a rock concert, I mean, a lot of times you will see a lot of different ages there. So I think rock and roll has somehow broken down some of the musical barriers, but still, I mean, now we're into hip hop and and rap and things like that, which are certainly different than rock and roll, even though the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame says they aren't. But, yeah, so I heard your basic Buddy Holly songs on oldie stations back in the, you know, the 80s and 70s and stuff. You're That'll Be the Days and Peggy Sue, you know, songs like that. But a friend of mine in, I remember freshman year, I'll never forget this, freshman year, I was talking to him about music, and he said, well, what about Buddy Holly? Do you like Buddy Holly? And I'm like, yeah, I really do like the songs I know of him, but I don't really know a lot of his music, and I've never bought any of his albums. So he said, well, you know, I've got this great, greatest hits album of Buddy Holly. I think it's actually called 21 Greatest Hits. I'll never forget, the cover of it has like graffiti on a wall that says Buddy Holly Lives, I think, if that was the, I think that pretty much that was, and I wound up buying the album. But so he lends me this album, and I'll never forget this because it really was a revelation. There are those moments I think we all have in our lives when an event happens, and it doesn't have to necessarily revolve around music or movies or anything like that, but you know there's a time when all of a sudden you go, when you're thinking or your perspective on something, when you were exposed to something, just shift it. It's one of those epiphany moments. And I'll never forget this one. This was an epiphany moment for me. I took his Buddy Holly album home and put it on. And from the get-go, I was just enthralled. There were the songs I knew, That'll Be the Day and Peggy Sue, right? But then it got deeper. And I was hearing Not Fade Away, and I was hearing Oh Boy. And I was like, wow, this is great. And I just could not stop listening to that music. And I could not stop listening to Buddy Holly. And I remember coming back the next day to school, and I just went up to him. I said, oh my gosh, this is my favorite album right now. I mean, I can't get enough of Buddy Holly. So that was my introduction to Buddy Holly, thanks to Jim Troxell. If you're ever listening to this, Trox, you got me into Buddy Holly, so thank you. And ever since then, I have been a huge, huge, huge Buddy Holly fan. I have, you know, Buddy Holly pins that I used to put on my coat in the 80s, you know, cool, Mr. Cool, you know, with all my little, those little buttons that you'd put on your vests or, you know, your jean vest or your lapel on your coat. And I still do that, sadly. I have a great pin collection. I have to talk to you about my pin collection someday. I just went through it and was looking at some of them. I have some great pins, some great buttons, or as they say in Britain, some great badges. I still go on eBay and look up to see, you know, some kind of cool pin. So as you know, I have my festive pin. So I'm always, this pin thing is not anything new with me. This goes back many, many years. I've always loved to wear some ornamental thing on my body, whether it was an Elton John t-shirt or as a pin on my lapel or a festive pin, if you will, or a pin of my favorite band or whoever it was, or favorite actor. But I've got a pretty impressive collection of some really things that I are my favorites. So I just was totally immersed into Buddy Holly from a relatively young age, thanks to that album. So flash forward then to my honeymoon. And my wife and I, on our honeymoon, we go to London. And when we are there, when you go to London, you have to go to the West End where they have their theater. That's their version of Broadway, the West End, where all the theaters are and all the big plays as well as small plays and, you know, your Phantom of the Operas as well as your new plays that are experimental. It's all in the West End for the most part. That's the theater district of London. And so while we're there, we're looking for things to do, and I notice, I think we're just walking around, and I notice that at this theater, it says Buddy, the musical. And I'm like, oh, we've got to go see this. I'd love to see this. Wow, I heard about it for many years. It had been around, but I'd never seen it. And I'm like, okay, this is awesome. We're in London, and Buddy Holly is huge in England. While he was very popular here, like most American rockers from the 50s, they had immense influence on ultimately the baby boomer rockers that are now legends today. I mean, Buddy Holly was a huge influence on the Beatles and you know, Simon and Garfunkel, and as I said, Bruce Springsteen. But, you know, most of the British people, those British invasion folks from the early to mid-60s, were all influenced by Buddy Holly. They all name him. So it's not surprising that this show was doing very well in London, because London has just always been a very popular place for Buddy Holly and his music. So we went to the musical, and it was enjoyable, and it was great to hear. And I learned there was even some other songs that I didn't even know, that I learned even more, some new Buddy Holly songs that weren't on that Greatest Hits album, and more obscure songs that they put into the show. And I learned more about his story. I had read a lot about him, but this was interesting just to see it all played out. And so I really enjoyed the show, and I was so glad we went. And but I remember sitting in the audience. Now, this is 1990. This is long before I was doing any acting at all. I never even had been in a play of any kind. I never was in a play in high school. I was never in a play in college. I've always been, I've enjoyed public speaking. I have performed, if you will, in different kinds of venues, but never in a legitimate play where you are cast and you learn the lines and everything. I've always been up on stages doing a lot of different things in front of people, public speaking, performing, but never in a play. And this was years before. This was, like I said, 2003 was the first time I was ever in a play. So, you know, this is, 13 years later? So I had never even thought about at this point. But I remember watching this show, and obviously in the show, it goes through his life, and it culminates in a recreation of the final concert that Buddy Holly and Ritchie Valens, who had the hits La Bamba and Donna, and the Big Bopper, who was a disc jockey in Texas, whose real name was J.P. Richardson, but he was called the Big Bopper. And he had his big personality, kind of a big guy. And if you've heard his song Chantilly Lace, that was a huge song in 1958 and 59. And so that's why Buddy Holly was on this tour with him. Buddy was obviously already an established act. The Big Bopper had these hits. Ritchie Valens had Donna and La Bamba, and so that's why they were the headliners on this winter tour, this winter dance party tour that took them to the Midwest and took them to Iowa, and then ultimately they died in the plane crash after this show in Clear Lake. So I remember watching this show from the audience, and I remember seeing. And I've always loved the Chantilly Lace song. I first heard Chantilly Lace from, once again, I had to find music any way I could, when I saw the film American Graffiti. And actually, even before I saw the film, I heard the soundtrack. My cousin Louise, who was about 6 or 7 years older than me, and I really have to give her a lot of credit for exposing me to some music, because we'd go to their house all the time, and she was really into music. And she had the soundtrack to American Graffiti, which, if you've never heard it, you don't have it, you should have it in your collection, because it really is a perfect capsule of the late 50s and early 60s music. That's why it made that music made that film. It's an okay movie in terms of the story, but it was the music and the use of the music that George Lucas put into it. The music is almost a character itself in that film. And you cannot help but notice the music intentionally. It's there deliberately. It's meant to push the story along. It's meant to reflect what's going on in the story. It wasn't just by accident. And the soundtrack is just chock full amazing songs and songs of that era. So if you haven't, if you're not really that well-versed in 50s and 60s music, or even if you are, if you want a really good listen, which you can put from beginning to end and never hit the stop button, get the American Graffiti, the original American Graffiti soundtrack. And that was the first time I ever heard Chantilly Lace. My cousin Louise playing the American Graffiti album. Then I later saw the film. But if you ever heard the song, you know, it's the big bopper. And I mean, he could sing. He was a songwriter. He actually wrote another song, a couple of hits for other people as well. But his big hit was Chantilly Lace. And he basically used his skills as a DJ as well. He was a DJ in Texas. And, you know, it's the song that goes, "Hello, baby." Yeah, this is the Big Bopper speaking. Will I what? Oh, baby, you know what I like. I just love doing the bopper. So, Chantilly Lace and a pretty face and a ponytail hanging down, a wiggle and a walk and a wiggle and a talk. Lord, make the world go round. There ain't nothing in the world like a big-eyed girl that make me act so funny, make me spend my money, make me feel real loose like a long neck goose, like a girl. Oh, baby, that's what I like. How's that, folks? So, I remember seeing this play in London on my honeymoon. And I don't know why, but I said to myself, I could play that role. I could play that role. I don't know why I said that. It came out of nowhere. But when I remember that show, that's what I remember the most. I remember the Big Bopper role and me saying I could play that role. Now, as I said, as a kid growing up, I'm sitting in my room, I'm playing all my favorite songs. I'm standing in front of the mirror, and I'm singing all the songs. And you know, Elton's got a way of performing with the way he makes the faces and mugging. And I'd be playing the piano either on my dresser or on my bed. As later on, I became a Springsteen fan. I was playing my air guitar and doing, you know, the Springsteen lumbering walk and all those kind of little mannerisms that each have. I studied them very closely, and I was able to imitate those guys, you know. And so it always stuck in the back of my mind, right? So flash forward now. I discover Buddy Holly when I'm like 13 or 14 years old. Then when I'm like 26 or so, I see the Buddy Holly story on stage, and I see the Big Bopper in this play, and I say to myself, I could play that role. And I never thought about it again, like in those terms. So flash forward to now, 2006. I'm looking around. I've now been acting in plays for about 3 years, and I've been fairly successful. And when I'm auditioned, I've gotten the roles that I wanted in plays that I was interested in. And so I was having a lot of fun. And even though I was never formally trained as an actor, I think it was just something that came naturally to me. As I said, I performed in front of people. I was a movie critic for many years and a theater critic. So I saw actors. I was able to, you know, take in acting, and I read a lot about actors and acting, right, in my own interest in you know, in the entertainment and pop culture. And then I was watching actors, and I would see who I thought were good and who I didn't think were good and as individual actors, or how they were in a specific movie, and I would critique that. So I felt like I did get an education in acting by observing and critiquing and seeing what people did and saying, geez, I would have done it different. So who knows, maybe in the back of my mind, I was always a frustrated actor, but just never made that next step. But in 2003, I did. And I have to say very quickly, the reason I did was another friend, thanks to all my friends, right? a friend of mine from high school who I still see. I'm his son's godfather, in fact. So we were hanging out at his house throughout high school and college. And I had seen her in 2003. I'd seen my friend's mother at some kind of a get-together. And she said, oh, what are you up to now? I hadn't seen her in a while. She said, what are you up to now? And I was saying, oh, blah, 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 blah. And she said, you know, I always thought you would have been a great actor. And wow, did that hit me. I remember, once again, one of those epiphany moments I talked about. This was another one of those. It just sort of hit me. And I was like, you know, in maybe the back of my mind, I always thought I could be or should be or wanted to be, but I never heard anyone else tell me I should be. And she just made this kind of random comment. I'm sure she never even remembered saying it. But my gosh, did it stick with me. And I went home from that party, and I'll never forget, it was like in July, and I started to look for audition notices online and places like that. And I said, I am going to just see if I could do this. I've always wondered about it in the back of my mind, but I've never done it. And before it's too late, I'm going to do it. And if I audition and I don't get it, at least I'll know I tried. But I'm like, you know, I owe it to myself to at least try to do this. And so I found an audition for a production in the suburbs of, it's A Christmas Carol. So I figured, well, that's good. I know this show, right? I know this story. I know the characters. So this is something that I can, you know, feel comfortable in auditioning for. And sure enough, at my first audition, I was cast. Not as Scrooge, but we actually played about four or five different characters in the play. It was only five actors in the whole play. We did several different characters. So I played Bob Cratchit, and I played Mr. Fezziwig, and a few others. But my first play I ever auditioned for, certainly later in my life, certainly for you're an actor, and I got it. And I certainly got the bug. I loved the experience, and I continued and have continued now until COVID stopped things now more than a year ago. And I've probably done almost 50 plays since 2003. Caught myself again, right? So, but anyway, so in 2006, I see that there is a local production of Buddy, and there are auditions. And I'm like, wow. You know, in the back of my mind, you know, 15 years ago, I always thought I could play the Big Bopper. I'm going to go audition for this. And so I knew the words to Chantilly Lace. And, you know, usually when you go to an audition, you can do whatever song you want, but a lot of times they don't want you to do a song from the show. They want you to do another song. But I was like, you know what? I am so confident in my Big Bopper ability here that I'm just going to go in and do Chantilly Lace and say, here's my Big Bopper. Take them or leave them. You know, here's what you're going to get. If you're going to cast me as a Big Bopper, this is what you're going to get. You don't have to imagine how I would be by listening to one song and imagining how I would be. Here it is. I'm giving it to you. And so I even brought a little bell with me because, you know, at the beginning of the song, you know, he's on the phone, you know, that hello, baby. Well, that's him on the phone. Yeah, this is the Big Bopper speaking. Oh, honey, you know what I like. You know, he's talking to her on the phone. So I brought a little bell with me as the ringing of the phone. I don't know if that either helped or hurt my audition, but I went up there and I did the first couple of verses. And I laid it out there, and I did my moves, and thank you very much. And, you know, as is in many auditions, the directors and those making decisions rarely give you a lot of outward signs that they either liked you or not. They want to play it close to the vest because they're going to see a lot of people. They don't want to create any expectations. I mean, you know, most people that audition for plays, just like when you go on a job interview, you always think you did a pretty good job. unless it's a total disaster, right? So every time you audition, it's the same thing. I mean, a job interview is basically an audition, right? So I felt I did a good job. The director didn't seem negative or positive. So I walked out of there really not knowing, you know, how I'd done and if I'd gotten it. I knew that I really wanted it, though. Even when I was there in the lobby waiting to go on to audition, I was sort of looking around to see who was going to maybe be the big bopper just physically. I certainly had the build and the look for it. And I thought I had the deep voice, and I thought I did a pretty good big bopper. Because here, you know, I, as you know, if you listen to the podcast, I do 1,743 impersonations, and so I'm pretty good at impersonating. And I thought I did in this, I didn't have to create a new character. This was be the big bopper. So you know, I had seen pictures of the big bopper. I'd seen videos of him singing, you know, Chantilly Lace on early 50s television. So I think I did a pretty good job. But you never know. You never know. There's so many, things that go into an audition. So you just never know. You leave there hoping you did a good job, feeling you did a good job, and then you sit and wait. It's a harrowing experience if you're not an actor. The rejection and the waiting is so difficult. But at the end of the day, even though you get rejected and you wait and you are disappointed, you always keep going back because it's just something in your blood. It's just something in your DNA. And so about 3 or 4 days went, I hadn't heard anything, and I figured, well, I didn't get it. And then the phone rang, and the director called, and she said, I'd love you to be our big bopper. And oh, my gosh, I just was ecstatic. I was just ecstatic. I couldn't believe it. I was so happy because I thought I did a good job. And the chance to now be in this show that I had seen and in my mind said I could do that role, well, now it was put up or shut up, Jim. And I got through the first hurdle. I convinced a director I could. And so I was like, wow, this is going to be fun. Now, I'm in a rock and roll show. I never was in a musical before. And my first musical was in a play about one of my favorite performers, Buddy Holly. So it was all coming together. Now, an interesting sideline to this was right at this time, my mom was living with us. My dad had passed away the year before. My mom was living with us. She was in ill health and in very ill health. In fact, her health was really declining to a very serious stage. To the point that if I had any misgivings about doing the show, it was because of my mom's health. I mean, she had really declined over the last year. After my dad passed away, she had broken her hip twice, which is not a good sign. And she had dementia and early Alzheimer's. So it was a very difficult situation, to say the least. And if you've ever been in that situation, you know how difficult it is. And my wife and I were basically her caregivers. I mean, she lived with us and we were taking care of her. And it was a very difficult time. And actually, the acting for me was during that period was actually a nice distraction or release from the day-to-day stresses and pressures of having to care for her. And thankfully, my wife allowed me to go to rehearsals and find this outlet, and I would have to be away from home, you know, for a few days a week, a few hours at a time, and she would be home with my mom. And thank God that, you know, for her for doing that. It was so selfless of her to do that, but she saw that I needed that outlet. And so it was a difficult time. And it's right in the middle of this very difficult time. And I sort of saw the writing on the wall about my mom's health. And at the same time, amidst this kind of sad moment about the realization that my mom may be passing away soon, I get this amazing news that I'm going to be in this play. And that's the way life is sometimes, you know? To the point where I never thought it would happen this fast, but I was cast in that play, and about 7 to 8 days later, my mom passed away. In fact, on the first day of rehearsal, I almost didn't go because she was really declining. And I was like, you know, I really don't know if I should go because, you know, I would never forgive myself if I wasn't there if she did pass. But she seemed to be okay. And the play itself was not far from my home. It was close. It was only going to be a 2-hour rehearsal. So I said, well, you know, hopefully, I think she seemed stable enough at that time. But I remember when I came home, she was clearly declining and she died within days of that first rehearsal. And so it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. You know, you can't get much more descriptive than Charles Dickens, right? So it was a very emotional time for me. And I mean, my mom and I just had an amazing, and I know I've been saying that word a lot today, but we had just a bond that I've had with no other person. And so to lose her was, even though she was in decline and I thought I was prepared for her death, you never really are when your parent dies. And if one of your parents has passed away, you know that. And if they haven't, let me just tell you, as prepared as you think you may be, you will never be prepared for it. It's one of those relationships that is so ingrained in you that you can't forget. And you can't be prepared when that loss really hits. And so it was a very difficult time, but I got through it. And as I said before, immersing myself in this play certainly helped with my grieving and getting my mind off of it and doing something positive. And I certainly thought about my mom while I was rehearsing and tried to take that energy and put it into my performance and doing it for her and to say, geez, I just would want her to be so proud of me and, you know, and dedicating it in my mind to her and things like that. And so very much the wound was still very fresh of my mom's death. And at the same time, I tried to use it as a positive and as a tribute to her to do a great job. And so she never lived to see my Big Bopper, which is a sad regret of mine, but that's the way life is. But I do believe while she never saw it, she was certainly a part of it. She influenced it. She was with me on that stage when I did it. In fact, every night when I went on stage as the Big Bopper, I brought with me some of her cologne, her favorite cologne. It was very distinct smell, and we still had it, you know, in our home from after she passed away, and I didn't throw it out. I kept it. I still have the bottle. And right before I went on, I would spray my wrists with a little spray of her cologne. So when I went on stage, she would be with me. And because I had the microphone in my hand, when I was singing and speaking as the Big Bopper, I could smell it on my wrist. So I always felt like she was with me. And I still dedicate every play in the program to my mom because she was my biggest supporter. And so, but, you know, as I said, the wound was so fresh and I missed her so much. I wanted the memory of her with me. I wasn't ready to let that go and just let time pass with it. And now I, you know, but every so often I still have that bottle and I will spray it and just to remind me of her. But there I certainly did. Before every show, I sprayed my mom's cologne on my wrist. And while I was out on stage, I would smell that. And I would just, it would inspire me, and it would just get me to feel that she was with me and that she could see what I was doing, and it was all for her. And so I was just immersed in this Big Bopper role, and I don't know if my mom's passing, you know, was part of that, but I know I did it very well. I was getting a lot of compliments from people after the show, during rehearsals, and I really felt that, you know, this was a role that was, I said, when I was, you know, 10, 15 years before, I think I can do that role, and I was so proud that I was actually able to do it. And I do think that my mom actually helped me. I didn't want her to pass away for help me to you know, grasp this role and do it. But at the same time, it happened, and I tried, as I said before, to do what I could to keep her spirit alive, which I still do today. And so we did the show. There was a great a rock group under themselves of some young guys around Buddy Holly's age, early 20s, who became our Buddy and the Crickets. They were a three-man band. They were called Jay Solomon and the Empty Pockets. Now they're just the Empty Pockets. But they were a band of their own, just starting out. And they were young kids, but they loved old-time rock and roll. The bass player actually played a stand-up bass, like the guy in the Crickets. And Josh was skinny. And you put the glasses on him and you know, permed his hair a little, and he was Buddy Holly. So the casting was great. The show was very well produced. The director did an amazing job. And for a small local production, we sold out every show for, 3 or 4 weeks. So much so that the director, when we were done, at the end of 2006... she said, I think, you know, this was just a small production in a local suburban theater. She said, but I think that this show has some potential, and I think that we should try to launch it in Chicago, where a wider audience can see it. I'm confident enough with the key people that we have that this could be a very fun and successful and popular show. And so sure enough, in January of 2007, we did a new production with most of the same people on board, although we did lose our Richie Valens. But we got a new Richie Valens named Desmond Borges. And if you've ever watched television, Desmond now has been on many shows. He was on a lottery commercial several years ago, where he was in the crowd and he won the lottery when he was in a Bulls game, and now I can't remember the name of the show he was on. It was on FX. Oh, I can't remember. Well, I'll remember. Look up his name, Desmond Borges. But I mean, this guy, I worked with him for 4 months, and now he's been on television. I see him on red carpets, and one time I even saw him on a plane in a movie he was in. He's really, you know, become a very accomplished actor. And he was very good as Richie Valens. So we did this show at a theater in Chicago called the Mercury Theater, which is right in Wrigleyville. It's about a 300 or 400 seat theater. And it was right next to a bar called Cullen's and right down the street from the Music Box Movie Theater. So if you know that area, it's on Southport near Addison, between Addison and Irving. And the Mercury is still open. I don't know now with COVID if it will be, but it was a good space. It was a good place to do this show. And we not only had most of our cast back, but then we got some more people. We got a bigger, better set and bigger, you know, band and everything like that. And we got some very good reviews, including a very good review from Chris Jones of the Chicago Tribune. And he described my performance as crowd-pleasing. So I don't know if that was good or bad, but certainly my goal has always been to entertain the people. So I think I did a good job, right? If my performance was crowd-pleasing, then I think I did my job. And it was great to be able to expose you know, my acting on a wider scale and to play this character that I really enjoyed playing to a wider audience. And we that production sold out through its run from like January through the end of March. So it was a very fulfilling show. And as I said before, what I really enjoyed about it was I got to live out all of my rock and roll fantasies. Because in my Big Bopper, There were aspects of Elton's performance. There were aspects of Bruce Springsteen's performance, especially playing to the crowd and playing with the crowd. In fact, I suggested, and we did it, if you remember the video for Dancing in the Dark, there's a scene, you know, in that video, a young Courtney Cox is brought up on stage and she dances with Bruce Springsteen. So because the Big Bopper, you know, was such a crowd-pleasing performer and character in this, and was talking to the crowd within the play while he was performing, I said, you know, could we possibly, during one of the verses of, you know, of Chantilly Lace, could I get a microphone and actually go down into the crowd and pick some woman in the front row or so and sing right to her and really bring the show into the crowd? And so we tried it, and it worked, and it became one of the most popular parts of the show, and I loved doing it. And that was kind of my Bruce Springsteen moment of getting in the crowd with the people, as well as I said, you know, my moves were kind of Elton-ish, and I got to wear a leopard jacket, which was very Elton-ish, and then I got to, you know, sing with this deep voice and get the crowd into like Springsteen. So I used all those concerts that I had seen Bruce Springsteen perform and all those concerts that I have seen Elton John perform. I channeled and I took what I could and made of my own Big Bopper. And I was so proud. It was so fun. And I had such a great time. And then this kind of other part of it, bringing my mom into it and her memory. And so I just have to say that that was one of the best personal experiences I've ever had, one of the best professional experiences I ever had. I still keep in touch with the Empty Pockets. In fact, Josh, who played Buddy Holly, wound up meeting one of the backup singers and dancers in the play, and now they're married, and she's a member of the Empty Pockets. So you never know. But, and I've had them on my radio show on WGN several times to perform, and we've sung some songs together as well. So I've still kept in touch with them over the years. I can't believe it's been 14 years, but it remains a special moment in my life, in my career. And there were so many weird little moments that all tied in together. You know, sometimes I still think that life is just very random. That's my perspective on things. But there are times when life, things just fall into place in an odd way, and it makes no sense, and it comes out of nowhere. But there is some kind of a linear direction to something, and you wouldn't expect it. You never, you know, plan on it. But if you look back at it, and I look at this Big Bopper experience, and I say it dates back to when I was 9 or 10, discovering Buddy Holly through Elton John and Bruce Springsteen, going to when I was 13 or 14 and getting that first Buddy Holly album and listening to That'll Be the Day in Chantilly Lace, you know, as a 9 or 10-year-old from my cousin Louise, and it's sticking in my mind. Chantilly Lace, that's the one song I always remember listening to from that album. It stuck out the most for me from that entire album. It was always Chantilly Lace. Then I go to see this play on my honeymoon years later, and for some reason I see that role and I say, I could do that without no experience, without any thought of ever acting or really doing it. And then 15 years later, I'm doing it. And, you know, and at this, at a time when the worst thing in my life ever happened, my mom passed away. And at that same time, I'm doing something that remains one of the highlights of my life and my career. And it does seem like it was meant to be. So, and so as I always think of life as, you know, we're just on this planet and it's random and we make our own. But then something like that happens and you go, wow, how did those stars align by accident, or was there something else happening? We don't have the answers. I don't pretend to have the answers. But when I think back about my Big Bopper experience, and I look at that linear progression to when it happened, it's just something that, if it wasn't planned out, my gosh, did it work out well? And if it was, I'm really glad I got a chance to see it through. Hello, baby! And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Don't forget, every Monday a new episode is posted at WGN Radio, or we can be found wherever you go to find your favorite podcasts. And don't forget, tell your friends, send them a link, send them a message, tell them that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and why the heck isn't it theirs? Your loyalty, devotion, and that extra effort is most appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 251. I'm Jim Tarano. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, from the end of the web to your screen. Hello, baby. Yeah, this is the Big Bopper speaking. Do I what? Will I what? Oh, baby, you know what I like.